Welcome to Bloomberg Opinion on Bloomberg Radio, bringing you news, comments, and insights from Bloomberg Opinion's worldwide team of editors and columnists. I'm your host, June Grosso. This week, columnist Frank Wilkinson explains why one Republican still knows right from wrong. Also on the show, the end of Jobs Day as we've come to know it. But first, in 2019, U.S. GDP grew by 2.3%, well below the 3% rate that President Trump and his allies promised following the corporate tax cuts. Bloomberg Economics is now forecasting that economic growth will slow even further in 2020 to 2.1%. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin blamed the slower growth on Boeing and the 737 MAX grounding. He said this on Fox Business last week.
Now, let me just say there's no question that the Boeing situation is going to slow down the GDP numbers. Boeing is one of the largest exporters, and with the 737 MAX, I think that could impact GDP as much as 50 basis points this year. But, we look forward to very healthy growth in 2020.
Brooke Sutherland, industrials columnist for Bloomberg Opinion, writes that Boeing deserves blame for many things, but dragging U.S. economic growth below 3% isn't one of them. And she's here to tell us why. Brooke, can you give some context about what Mnuchin said regarding GDP and Boeing?
So the Trump administration has long had this goal of growth coming in at 3% on an annual GDP basis. And so this was their goal for 2019. They did not, in fact, achieve it. And it was also the goal for 2020. But Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin appeared to walk that back somewhat on Fox Business, saying that that growth would be cut by about 50 basis points in large part because of the grounding and subsequent production halt of Boeing 737 MAX.
So did he misspeak, or is the administration targeting Boeing as the culprit?
Well, that's an interesting question, because they also did publish, the Trump administration's budget came out this year and appears to still be targeting 3% growth for 2020. And Wilbur Ross spoke at Davos and was saying that he expected growth to be above 3%, even though the Boeing MAX production halt had already been announced at that point in time. So it's not really clear where the administration falls on its goals, but it does strike me, that they seem to be setting up a situation where any type of shortfall can be blamed on Boeing, which I don't think is accurate. I think if you look at the median forecast for economists going back over a long period of time, it hasn't been above 2% since, I believe, May 2018, which was nearly 6 months before that first Boeing plane crashed. The plane, of course, was not grounded until March 2019, following the second fatal crash and the production halt. They did take production down, somewhat over the course of 2019 to accommodate the fact that the plane was grounded, but the full-blown halt wasn't actually announced and didn't take effect until January.
So how much can you blame Boeing? How much of a chunk?
Certainly, it's going to be an impact on the economy. Boeing is the largest U.S. exporter, and you have to think about not just Boeing, but all of these suppliers that support Boeing in the production of the 737 MAX. We've already heard from Spirit AeroSystems, which makes the body of the plane and gets more than 50% of its revenue from Boeing's 737 MAX program, that it's cutting 2,000 jobs. They also had to cut their dividend. They saw their credit rating cut. So this definitely does have significant financial ramifications, but most economists' estimates that I've seen talk about, a 50 basis point hit in the first quarter, and then you do make some of that up over the course of the year because production will come back. It's unlikely that you stay at a zero level for the rest of the year.
So is it possibly a way to avoid talking about the impact of the trade war?
I think that it is certainly easier to point the finger at Boeing than to point the finger at itself. I think if you think about what's been weighing on GDP from the industrial side, it's certainly been the trade war. Not necessarily the tariffs themselves, although that does create an increased cost for these companies, but it's just the uncertainty. And so, the way in which the trade war was carried out, where you would have you know, sort of this will he or won't he constant debate about whether or not we're going to actually see tariffs, whether some of these more dramatic actions that were threatened by the Trump administration might come to the fore. I know the one that really scared a lot of CEOs was when, you know, it looks like we had a new NAFTA that was negotiated and the Trump administration was pushing Congress to ratify that. And then at the same time, he threatened to put tariffs on all Mexican goods in an effort to sort of spur them to crack down on illegal immigration. And that really caught a lot of people by surprise in terms of just the unpredictable nature of these trade wars. And I think that has lingered. And you're not really seeing the step up in demand that people thought would be so forthcoming once we finally did get this deal. I think that's back end weighted at best, but it's not really clear where you're going to get a lot of orders growth on the industrial side.
Yeah. So what have you been hearing generally from industrial companies about growth?
It's very slow still, you know, so we just heard from most companies on their fourth quarter results, and it was fairly lackluster. I mean, I think if you look at names like Caterpillar and 3M that tend to sit at intersections of different parts of the economy, they're not really seeing a lot of growth. And a company like CSX, which is a railroad which carries goods from all different kinds of industries, is calling for potentially a decline in sales again in 2020. And so, you know, I think most companies are hoping that things pick back up in the back half of the year. But I get really nervous when these companies start projecting, you know, turnarounds in the back half of the year. I mean, I think that does not tend to be a conservative approach. And there are a lot of different variables. I mean, you think about the presidential election, what in fact happens with this coronavirus crisis. And so I think there are a lot of what ifs to that optimism.
Thanks so much, Brooke. That's Brooke Sutherland, industrials columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. Last week, Utah Senator Mitt Romney was the sole Republican who voted to convict President Trump on one article of impeachment. Prior to the Senate vote, Romney said this on the Senate floor.
Were I to ignore the evidence that has been presented and disregard what I believe my oath and the Constitution demands of me for the sake of a partisan end, it would, I fear, expose my character to history's rebuke and the censure of my own conscience.
Bloomberg Opinion editor Frank Wilkinson wrote that Utah Senator Mitt Romney may be this generation's Joseph Welch, and he's here to tell us why. So remind us who Joseph Welch is.
Joseph Welch was the lawyer for the Army at the Army-McCarthy hearings in 1954. And he sort of won a place in political culture and popular culture when he stood up to Senator Joseph McCarthy, who had really been on a several-year rampage by that point in accusing people in Hollywood, in the State Department, in the Army, everywhere around, of being communist. And, of course, he was enormously reckless and dishonest. He'd say in West Virginia one day he had proof of 57 communists in the State Department. By the next day, it would be 91 or whatever. You know, I mean, he didn't care about his lies enough to keep track of them. He would just sort of throw things out there. And famously, Welch said to McCarthy, after McCarthy attacked a young lawyer, you know, "Have you no sense of decency, sir?" And that kind of has become cemented in American political culture as the moment that the tide turned against McCarthyism in this country.
We all have our views of McCarthyism, but you write that at that time he did have a lot of supporters.
Sure, millions. McCarthy had power for the same reason that Trump has power. He had less power than Trump because he didn't have the presidency. But Trump's power ultimately is derived from tens of millions of supporters. And McCarthy had millions of supporters as well. He had people who did not care whether he lied, as Trump has people who don't care whether he lies. He had people who did not care whether he destroyed the careers of innocent people and just ruined their lives, as people don't much care whether Trump does that too. So there's some very similarities, and frankly, there are a lot of similarities between McCarthy and Trump, the kind of the recklessness, the inattention to detail, even in their wild assaults, is very similar.
So would you compare Utah Senator Mitt Romney to Joseph Welch?
Well, I did, because it was a singular moment. When Mitt Romney went down to the Senate and gave his remarks on convicting Trump. He voted to convict on one of the articles of impeachment, and he was the only Republican to do so. And just as when Joseph Welch challenged McCarthy, and Welch was saying something that basically everyone in the room, everyone in Washington, everyone in much of the country understood McCarthy was a liar and a demagogue, and all of Mitt Romney's colleagues understand that very well about Trump. They know he's a demagogue. They know he lies. They know he's undoubtedly guilty of what he was accused of doing. I mean, the evidence was overwhelming. So it was a similar scenario in one person standing up and saying the emperor has no clothes like that. Now, Welch did not end the reign of McCarthy. McCarthy was beginning to be on the way down by that point. And Mitt Romney will not end the reign of Trump. But those kinds of singular episodes of courage where one person stands up in a very challenging environment and shows courage. I mean, Romney has already been attacked by Trump. He will be attacked by the kind of goons who support what Trump does and want to, wage threats against Romney or his family. I mean, those things happen. We all know that. So it was something that Romney was very consciously and verbally, he stated, he was aware he was going to be attacked, and viciously so. And, you know, he stood up and he did it. So I thought it was worthy of that comparison to Welch.
Did Welch suffer the backlash that Romney suffered immediately?
No, because, again, McCarthy was a senator. Okay, so he was a powerful senator because he was a demagogue and he had followers and he was able to shape public events to his advantage. But he was not president of the United States. He hadn't warped the entire executive branch to his will as Trump has done. Dwight Eisenhower was the president of the United States. He was no fan of McCarthy, and he was certainly not willing to bend the executive branch to McCarthy's will. Trump obviously has an executive branch. He's got an attorney general who's been absolutely willing to bend the Justice Department. He has other departments of government that have been willing to bend their other cabinet secretaries have been willing to bend their departments. Look at Mike Pompeo at State Department. So Trump is immensely more powerful than a mere demagogic senator from the 1950s. And he's still got the full strength of his viciousness to be deployed against Romney.
Looking at the Romney situation and listening to what everyone has to say, I have yet to figure out any kind of motive that he would have other than what he said.
Well, I think it'd be very difficult to find a political motive. Politically, he will suffer. Even though Utah is not as pro-Trump territory as a lot of other Republican red states are, there's still plenty of Trump supporters in Utah. I don't think that Mitt Romney is going to gain anything politically in the near term from this challenge. All the evidence we have is that any Republican who challenges Trump, like Jeff Flake did, who was very quickly drummed out of the Republican Party. Justin Amash did, the one House Republican who supported impeachment against Trump and then had to leave the party. So there's a very clear pattern of what happens to Republicans who stand up and say the truth about Trump.
Can you think of another president who had this much power over his party?
There have been presidents who've had a lot of power over their party. There has not been a president who had this level of power over their party and was fundamentally corrupt, as Donald Trump is.
Thanks, Frank. That's Frank Wilkinson, an editor for Bloomberg Opinion. The number of women dying of complications of pregnancy and childbirth is going down in all developed countries except the United States. New statistics released last week show that the U.S. maternal death rate has continued to climb. It's now 4 to 6 times higher than in many European countries. So why has the maternal mortality rate gotten worse in the U.S. but not in Europe? Here to tell us is Faye Flam, a columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. So Faye, first tell us about the rising rates in the U.S.
Yeah, it's very interesting that the rates of pregnancy-related deaths have been going down, as you would expect, as medical technology gets better in all of the developed countries, except in the U.S., where it's been going up and is quite a bit higher than anywhere else in the developed world. We're comparable to, I think, Russia and Ukraine. So there were new figures just released by CDC. There had been a long gap, 11 years between releasing numbers, and the trend seems to be continuing.
So now you say it's tied to the rising rates of heart disease?
Yes. Well, this is sort of interesting. I had just come back from a training session put on by the National Press Foundation on heart disease, and a lot of the sessions were focused on women's health. As it turns out, heart disease is the number one killer of women in the higher age groups. And as it turns out, 30 to 40% of pregnancy-related and maternal deaths are associated with heart disease.
In your column, you have some scary facts about pregnancy and the massive physical strain it imposes.
Yeah, and this came from one of the speakers at this fellowship symposium. She is a cardiologist, a cardiology professor, and she said, you know, the cardiology profession didn't really pay much attention to pregnancy, but she realized it was an important issue, and she started to make this a subspecialty of hers. And she talked about how there's this huge strain on the body when a woman is pregnant. It actually makes all kinds of changes, vascular changes, changes in blood volume, the heart rate changes, the way the heart pumps actually changes a little bit. Really, really interesting. And these changes apparently persist for weeks after a woman gives birth.
I didn't know this, but you related the story about Serena Williams. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So one thing, the statistics show that the rate of maternal mortality is much higher for African-American women than for any other women in the U.S., twice as high as the rate for Hispanic or white women. And there were a couple of really interesting stories in the New York Times about Serena Williams. She almost died from complications of her childbirth, and she had blood clots. Apparently, she knew she had a clotting disorder, but the people in the hospital didn't take her seriously and didn't believe that the symptoms she was having were related to that for a long time.
And cardiologists don't usually get training dealing with pregnant women who have these increased complications and problems?
Well, it may change. I think this one woman who talked to us is trying to make a change. You know, women are having kids at older and older ages, and Americans are developing heart disease at younger and younger ages. So this intersection between people who are still young enough to have kids and old enough to have heart disease is really growing. And I think apparently, according to her, it's not standard for cardiologists to get any special training in dealing with pregnant women, but that's something that could change in the future.
So now the big question is, why is the problem getting worse in the United States but not in Europe?
I think some of it is the creeping up of heart disease, that heart disease is going up. There have been some really interesting new statistics on heart disease going up among younger people, and that could be a big factor. So just having that creep up could be part of it. Healthcare access could be another part. Obesity is related to that. So if the obesity rate is continuing to creep up, that could be part of it too. But there's definitely more to investigate here. I don't think that the experts completely understand all the reasons for this.
And California is trying something new here?
Yeah, so, you know, there seem to be a lot of differences by state, and California is trying to address the problem and have brought their statistics down by really trying to have more comprehensive health care for pregnancy and birth and the period afterwards.
Thank you, Faye. That's Faye Flam, a columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. Starting on March 1st, the news media will face new limits on special access to market-moving data in the U.S., including the monthly jobs report. The U.S. Labor Department said it will ban computers from so-called lockup rooms where journalists receive advance access to major economic reports. So how will these new reporting limits impact the markets? Bloomberg Opinion columnist Brian Chapata is here to tell us. So explain what normally happens around the release of the job report and what happened this last time.
Yeah, so usually what happens is the Labor Department will give select media outlets the data an hour ahead of time. So the data comes out at 8:30 Eastern time. Media outlets like Bloomberg, like Reuters, like other outlets will get the data at 7:30, and they'll have an hour to effectively go through the data themselves, pick out what's important, write their articles. It's on a computer. The computer is disconnected from everything. It's not connected to the internet, can't release the numbers. And then at 8:30, a switch is flipped, and they're able to basically release everything all at once to their news subscribers. And so now what's going to happen going forward after this latest jobs day is there will be no computers, which effectively makes the whole exercise somewhat useless because you'll have to run back to a locker, grab your cell phone, and call the number. So what's going to happen is you're going to have to go and look at the website of the Labor Department.
Let's back up a little bit. Why did the Labor Department decide this? No computers.
Well, they thought it would level the playing field was the argument. And there's also been concerns that somehow the data would get leaked somehow, even though there's really no possible way to do that. But the idea was to level the playing field for those who don't have access to the news services that provide headlines instantaneously at 8:30. This would create a better opportunity to just have everyone go through the website, the Labor Department's website, and get the jobs numbers themselves. The issue, of course, is that it's still not really a level playing field because those who have the greatest technology that are able to scrape the website will get first crack at the numbers.
How has it been going at the Agriculture Department?
There's been some hiccups. There was one point at which a crucial Agricultural Department data set did not come out for 6 minutes. And so traders were left kind of blind. Corn prices reacted quite a bit and then ultimately came back down to earth after the release came out. So it really raises the risk that some of these government websites could be vulnerable to a hack or some sort of cybersecurity risk. It reduces the number of avenues that the information that's really important to traders and for economic data gets disseminated.
So how do the traders feel about this?
Traders actually don't seem to care quite as much, which is kind of funny. They basically see it as same old, same old. Like I was saying about leveling the playing field, they still see it as mostly an uneven playing field. High-frequency traders will invest in what's needed to get the data the fastest to their computers to make the algorithmic trades. And that's just going to happen anyway. There's still going to be a movement immediately at 8:30, possibly more movement, more volatility, because no one's going to know instantly what's happening. But most traders say, I'm not the type of person that will press a button 1 second after the release anyway. I'm going to use my own knowledge to digest the numbers and then react accordingly.
So unless there is some snafu by the Commerce Department or hacking, this might be much ado about nothing?
Possibly. I mean, we'll have to see what happens when it actually takes effect. I think there will be a lot, assuming that this goes through. Bloomberg and other news organizations have protested once more, saying that this should not be happening with the lockup procedure. But assuming this does go through, I do think there'll be a lot of scrutiny around the first release, and it might change some people's procedures because it is very easy to. I mean, that's what I do. I go through our headlines, and we're able to see an instant snapshot of what's important, whether it's wage growth, whether it's data making or missing expectations. It might just take people a little bit longer to say, okay, this is the number. This is what economists were expecting. Is this really good? Is this really bad? Is this about what was in line with expectations?
So they were going to try this in 2012. What stopped them in 2012?
Yeah, well, the arguments that were made this time were made last time and were successful. They effectively said, look, we're helping you. We're disseminating this data. It's important for seasoned journalists who have been covering these economic releases for a long time to accurately process the data and get them to Wall Street. And that was a successful argument now. And so far, it hasn't really resonated with this administration.
What are you expecting on the next jobs day?
Well, I do think there's definitely going to be some heightened volatility, at least initially, because I just don't think that anybody's really prepared for the idea that things could be slightly delayed. And any sort of delay in anything makes people anxious for whatever reason. I mean, maybe it's just the computers getting anxious. We don't even really know at this point. But I think there's going to be a lot of interest around if this changes things, because Jobs Day so far in last, you know, for a while has been, it's been an important release, no doubt, but it's been pretty much steady as, you know, steady as they go with the numbers. It's been a pretty solid labor market. So it'll be interesting to see if and when that turns, especially if there is this less transparency now.
Thanks so much, Brian. That's Brian Chipata, a columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. Last week, Citigroup suspended one of its highest-profile junk bond traders, Parrish Shah, after he allegedly stole food from the company cafeteria on numerous occasions. That's according to a person familiar with the matter. Did the company go too far in suspending him? Here to tell us more is Sarah Green Carmichael, an editor for Bloomberg Opinion. Sarah, start by telling us about this Citigroup trader. How much did he make and what happened?
Yeah, so his estimated salary is about $1 million a year. And what happened was that this trader, Parrish Shah, 31 years old, was seemingly let go from the company for allegedly stealing items from the company cafeteria. Now, this is not a case of him just taking too much of the free snacks lying around the office. It seems that there was an actual cafeteria and he was supposed to pay and he didn't. And now he's gone.
So you compare this to stealing pencils from the office or taking extra pens from the office?
I do. And I'm being a little cheeky here, but I think, you know, there was one study from a few years ago that showed maybe half of people in the office admit to taking something they maybe weren't supposed to from the office, anywhere from a pen to a package of pens to something bigger. And I kind of have the feeling that the other half might have been skipping. I think most of us have probably taken at least a pen we shouldn't have taken from the office. And I think that most companies kind of understand that. You know, you're writing with something and you just go home, and then maybe that pen just finds its way into your kitchen. But I think food is a little different. You know, if you have a company cafeteria, you're probably not supposed to be swiping that food. And I think companies have become a lot more sensitive in recent years to any kind of behavior that looks unethical or a violation of company policy. And unfortunately, this is a case where a trader made a really poor cost-benefit decision. You know, he took a risk by choosing not to pay for food at the cafeteria. And it seems that it has cost him a very lucrative job that no doubt paid him enough to pay for his lunch.
So do you think companies are cracking down on this because of the bottom line or because of ethical considerations?
I think it's really ethical considerations. Whatever the cost of the item actually is, it's not enough usually to make a big stink over or to lose a valuable employee. But I think what's starting to happen is that some very successful companies, like tech companies, are giving stuff away at a rate that we have not seen possibly ever. The amount of high-quality free food, for example, given out at places like Google or LinkedIn is really off the charts. And so it's understandable that this could create a sense of resentment or temptation among employees who have to pay for their lunch, who might think that they're just as talented as some Silicon Valley software engineer. So I think what's probably happening is a rise in unethical behavior, and then we're also seeing more companies cracking down on it because there's more of the behavior to crack down on in the first place.
How much of it is workers working long, long weeks and thinking they're not getting paid enough for it?
Yeah, I think it really speaks to the blending of work and life. If you are working all the time, you might feel your company owes you a little bit more than they're giving you. And this is, I think, especially true when you see things like people bringing work home with them on the weekends. They might think, well, why shouldn't I bring some of the stuff from my office home as well if I'm bringing the work home? So I think as work and life become one, some of these distinctions that once seemed so clear become really arbitrary.
So tell us about some of the studies that you say found that even thinking about money makes us less ethical.
Yes, this is a fascinating area of research, and one that has actually been fairly well studied. Money makes us react differently to all kinds of things. So in one experiment, participants exposed to money were twice as likely to lie as a control group that had not been exposed to money. In another very well-known experiment, drivers of luxury cars were more likely to ignore crosswalks and also to steal the right-of-way at a four-way stop. And in fact, drivers of Mercedes were the most likely to have these kinds of traffic violations compared with, say, someone who's driving a budget Honda or budget Toyota. People driving those cars were much more obedient. So there's also another study that shows that thinking of money makes us ignore pain. People were able to hold their hands in a bucket of icy water for longer if they were thinking about money. So money can make us do some pretty funny things, and some of it is good if you think about it. Maybe it makes you work a little harder or endure some emotional pain at the office, but some of it is not so good, and that's when you're kind of starting to cut corners or maybe take things that you shouldn't be taking.
Thanks, Sarah. That's Sarah Green Carmichael, an editor for Bloomberg Opinion. And that's it for this edition of Bloomberg Opinion. You can read more at Bloomberg.com/opinion or at OPI and Go on the Bloomberg Terminal. For Bloomberg Radio, I'm June Grosso. Thanks for listening, and remember to tune into the next edition of Bloomberg Opinion right here on Bloomberg Radio.